This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Annihilation of Afghanistan, Part 2. Today on Taking Aim, we continue our discussion of the war against the people of Afghanistan. But first, let's go to Ralph Poynta for a further update on the case of Lynn Stewart. Ralph, how are you?
Fine, Maya. And how are you and Ralph doing?
We're doing okay. Thanks, Ralph. Was at the rally for Lynn and for political prisoners in Los Angeles on Saturday. Big turnout and support for Lynn across the board.
I've noticed as people begin to recognize the Jekyll and Hyde situation we have with the presidency, that more people are beginning to look at the injustices brought on by the Obama-Bush continuum. And, you know, I visited Lynn yesterday. She's in surprising health and good spirits when considering the prison food fare. Sugared cereals are the only option, and oatmeal if you have commissary. But those without commissary who have diabetes or difficulties such as that are in trouble. Her mail has been freed up for maybe a week after having been frozen for weeks and constantly censored. Lynn thanks everybody constantly for the support she's been given, and she feels she can best be supported by making the world aware of the government's persistent selective prosecution of her through the Bush-Cheney years and continuing the Obama administration, the ability to look the other way when not seeing what happened with the Guantanamo lawyers' heroic representation of the Guantanamo inmates. The Guantanamo lawyers totally disregarded the court orders that would limit their representation of the Guantanamo detainees. While Lynn Stewart is doing time for making a press release, this we must bring to the people. That whole thing of equal justice under the law, double standards while applying the law, separate but unequal, selective prosecution has been a problem ever since the beginning of this nation. And the Obama administration is determined to continue in this unjust direction. And we must be more determined to do our work to stop this.
What we should note particularly is that the persecution of Lynn, while starting under the Bush administration, is continued by the Obama administration Department of Justice, which is insisting still on a 30-year sentence for Lynn.
Death sentence for Lynn is what they're asking for.
Yes, and Judge Kodal himself stated that the Department of Justice was looking for a life sentence, which in this case would be a death sentence for Lynn, because with 30 years, it would be anticipated that she would be dying within prison. Along with this, we need to note some recent actions by the Obama administration escalating, deepening a so-called war on terror, which ends up being a war on the people of the United States, as well as peoples of the world. The Obama administration recently justifying the policy of targeting U.S. citizens for murder, that is assassination, by citing the September 14, 2001 Congressional Act, the Authorization to Use Military Force. This measure allows the U.S. president, quote, to use all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11, 2001, end quote. And what we're looking at here is the part where it says persons, because what President Barack Obama has done is he has approved the targeted killing of a U.S.-born Muslim cleric, that is a U.S. citizen, for targeted killing. This is Anwar al-Awlaki.
Maya, but Anwar al-Awlaki is only the convenient opportunity, as it were, because for the first time in the history of the United States, an American president has officially not merely ordered the assassination of a U.S. citizen, but he has declared that anyone who is aiding or supporting enemies of the United States can and will be ordered to be killed. I'm talking about U.S. citizens, and the definition of that is as broad as it can be. What that tells me, brothers and sisters, is that any of us who are supporting resistance to imperialism, resistance to the brutal and dictatorial and totalitarian regimes that are subject to imperial control and agents and instruments of imperial dominion, any of us who resist, any of us who support the right of self-determination and the right to resist are enveloped within this category and are subject to being literally ordered to be killed. No trial, no charge, no due process, no nothing.
And you see how dangerous this is. We are all on the list to be assassinated by the government legally, and Lynn Stewart is doing time because she has resisted. And our argument now is, well, we have others who have done it before her, and now we have others who have done it after her, and they are out of jail, and she is in jail. What about that? So one of the things that we have to make people aware of is exactly what's happening. You could be killed by government order. I could be killed by government order because someone in the government put us on the list for supporting terrorism, although there was no such thing. And Lynn Stewart is in jail for supporting, so-called supporting terrorism, although she did no such thing. And this is where our government is. And we just have to dig deep to save ourselves and Lynn Stewart. And as she so eloquently puts, don't just talk about Lynn Stewart. Talk about Mumia Abu-Jamal. Talk about Leonard Peltier, who have served this horrendous time unjustly. And we must work towards that. And I thank you so much, Ralph and Maya, for bringing your information. And I'm sitting here with bated breath, waiting to hear it one more time.
Thanks, Ralph.
Please, brothers and sisters, write to Lynn Stewart.
150 Park Row, New York, New York, MCC 53504-054 2S. And it's New York, New York 1007. Thank you for the time, and I don't want to cut into the valuable information you're going to give.
Thanks so much, Ralph.
Thanks, Ralph. We'll be with you next week.
Thank you.
Much love.
Now, The Annihilation of Afghanistan, Part 2. Monday, April 12th. Headline in the New York Times: Civilians killed as U.S. troops fire on Afghan bus. Squeezed between a convoy, in front and in back, a passenger bus was making its way along the main highway in Sazari, 15 miles west of Kandahar. An article by Richard Opel Jr. and Taimer Shah describes a harrowing experience for the passengers on this bus. Quote, American troops raked a large passenger bus with gunfire near Kandahar on Monday morning, killing as many as 5 civilians and wounding 18, sparking anger in a city where winning over Afghan support is considered pivotal to the war effort. The American-led military command called the killings a tragic loss of life and said troops fired not knowing the vehicle was a bus and believing that it posed a threat to a military convoy clearing roadside bombs from a highway. End quote. Not knowing it was a bus? What did they think it was?
Maya, the deaths triggered, as the New York Times describes it, a vitriolic anti-American demonstration, infuriated officials, and, as the Times puts it, is harming public opinion on the eve of the most important offensive of the war, in which tens of thousands of American NATO troops will seek to take control of the Kandahar region. Now, hundreds of demonstrators poured into the area where the damaged bus was taken on the western outskirts of Kandahar. They blocked the roads with burning tires for an hour and shouted death to America while condemning the Afghan President Hamid Karzai. The Kandahar governor, Turiyale Wesa, called for the commander of the military convoy who opened fire to be prosecuted under military law. If you want to stop a bus, You should shoot out the tires, Ms. Avesa said. Why are they shooting the people inside the bus? And the extraordinary nature of this is that this is a long, large bus traveling slowly, and it actually pulled off the road before they opened fire on it. Indeed, they opened fire at point-blank range.
They shot out the windows on an entire side of the bus. Two people who had been on the bus said that the American convoy was 60 to 70 yards ahead. That's 180 feet. When it opened fire as the bus was pulling to the side of the road to allow yet another military convoy to pass from behind. Let's look at this in great detail. You have a slow-moving convoy approaching the bus, a convoy that is checking the road for IEDs, that is, for bombs, and you have a faster-moving convoy coming up behind the bus. What is the bus driver to do? As he said, quote, I was going to take the bus off the road. Then the convoy ahead opened fire from the distance of 60 to 70 yards. This is the driver, Mohammed Nabi. As people on the bus say, we don't feel safe while traveling on the main highways anymore because of these NATO convoys. The escalation of force is the military term. Deadly force that is used on vehicles and people who are going past checkpoints or who are just traveling innocently on the road.
As if, by the way, and this is something I think it's essential for us to continue to remember, brothers and sisters, what constitutes the entitlement to be shot dead in cold blood, to be labeled an insurgent, to be counted amongst the opponents of the United States occupation. That entitles you to be murdered and killed. And the people who are being called innocent civilians are those who have no relationship even to a resistance, political, armed, or otherwise, to an occupation. And Maya, on March 26th, the New York Times ran an article entitled, Tighter Rules Fail to Stem Deaths of Innocent Afghans at Checkpoints. And the article by Richard Opel Jr. states, American and NATO troops firing from passing convoys and military checkpoints have killed Afghans and wounded others in numbers since last summer, and in no instance did the victims, quote, prove to be a danger to troops, according to military officials in Kabul, unquote. And that's where General Stanley A. McChrystal, who is essentially an organizer of targeted assassinations, that's his primary credential in Iraq, where they not only targeted people, but they staged operations and imputed them to so-called terrorists over the course of the war in Iraq. McChrystal stated, we have shot an amazing number of people, but to my knowledge, none has ever proven to be a threat. This is the senior American NATO commander in Afghanistan, and we've quoted that before, but I think it's important to make clear that what he's describing is not an abnormal circumstance, but the constant character of the terrorizing of the entire population in Afghanistan, instilling naked fear and terror into the population to induce their submission to permanent U.S. occupation. Indeed, many of the detainees, the article continues, at the military prison at Bagram Air Base have joined the insurgency after the shootings of people they knew, said the senior NATO enlisted man in Afghanistan, Command Sergeant Major Michael Hall. Story after story about how people have been turned into insurgents, Sergeant Major Hall told troops during a video conference. Every time there's an escalation of force, we are finding that innocents are being killed, unquote. The article continues, shootings from convoys and checkpoints involving American, NATO, and Afghan forces have accounted for 36 civilian deaths, with at least 30 Afghans killed since last June in 95 such shootings. And those numbers, the New York Times states, do not include shooting deaths caused by convoys guarded by private security contractors. Tallies put the total number of escalation of force deaths far higher.
Ralph, we cannot rely upon these statistics because in the recent bus shooting where they shot out all the windows on one side, the New York Times had reported in terms of the number of people injured will not be the number of people who are killed because 12 of the 18 people injured were injured seriously. McChrystal himself was admonished in the Tillman death. That was the friendly fire death of the former football player, Corporal Pat Tillman, in 2004, who was killed in friendly fire by the Army Rangers in Afghanistan. McChrystal was admonished for accepting inaccurate information that was provided by Tillman's unit. Ralph, let's look at some of the other assassinations and deaths, the targeted killing in Afghanistan, essentially creating free fire kill zones throughout Afghanistan. There are harrowing reports. I'd like to look at particularly events that took place last year. American Special Forces, accompanied by Afghan police, had entered a housing compound near Gardez in Paktia province on February 12th, where they killed a local police commander named Dawood, his brother, and three women, two of whom were pregnant, and the 15-year-old son was shot. This was a hunt for Taliban and insurgents. A NATO report on April 4th admitted that this was an execution-style killing. The unpublished UN report, which was obtained by The Times, showed actually that the occupation forces had broken at 3:30 a.m. while Dawood's extended family was celebrating the naming of a baby. The man who noticed them cried, "Taliban." Dawood and his son were gunned down as they ran into the courtyard to investigate. The brother, who recognized the assailants as Americans, was shot dead as he yelled in English, quote, "Don't fire, we work for the government." The three women were killed by either a blast of gunfire that entered the house or, according to witnesses cited in the New York Times article, they were gunned down as they attempted to help the men. The UN report stated that the remaining people in the compound were, quote, "assaulted by the U.S. and Afghan forces, restrained and forced to stand barefoot for several hours outside in the cold." There have been further investigations of this massacre, a massacre which typically the U.S. has said was an attack on a compound where there had been Taliban insurgents. Ralph?
Well, Maya, the deaths, as we have used, described them, are not the only casualties, and not actually the people who were wounded died as well. Dawood and his 18-year-old niece died of their wounds, according to the New York Times, due to lack of medical treatment. And indeed, at an initial press release by the U.S. NATO International Security Assistance Force, they put out the false story that three women had been tied up, gagged, and killed before the special forces attack. Later, they had to admit that this was a concocted and false story. Indeed, on February 21st, special forces in Uruzgan province called in a helicopter gunship strike on three trucks. They were observing, 27 people were killed. The occupants were all civilians and unarmed. An anonymous NATO official revealed to the New York Times, "What I saw in that video would not have led me to pull the trigger. It's one of the worst things I've seen. The nationality of the troops was not identified, but the Australian Special Air Service, the most active special force unit in Uruzgan province, has been blamed for numerous atrocities against civilians. And according to the London Times, Afghan and American troops raided the home of Rahmatullah Siddiqui, a 61-year-old shopkeeper in Ghazni province, the night before, and they shot dead his wife and son." This is ubiquitous. It's throughout Afghanistan. Helicopter gunships fire missiles into the guest room of a housing compound, Kharkiv village in Wardak province. killing three. Locals claim a landing party of occupation troops entered the home, shot dead its owner, his wife, and his son. Another child was seriously wounded. Almost every day there is a report of such atrocities across. This is not just a matter of incidents. This is the character of the occupation. The objective is to terrorize the population through cold-blooded murder, so that there is such a reign of terror at work in Afghanistan that you will have a cowed population. The publicity given to McChrystal's directive by the New York Times has all of the hallmarks of a public relations stunt intended to provide the appearance that McChrystal, of all people, is reining in special force operations when, in fact, he is the author of them. The entire military strategy of the occupation in Afghanistan, drawn up by McChrystal and before him General David Petraeus, has been based upon the use of what are death squads to terrorize the Afghan population into complete submission. And civilians who die in this process are considered to be assets to the program. They are treated by Obama, his White House, and the Pentagon as not merely collateral damage, but as the objective of the exercise.
Ralph, we have to recall that McChrystal, trained at West Point, was a Green Beret and a veteran Special Operations Commander. And that is exactly, as you mentioned before, what he did in Iraq. In Iraq, where he served under Petraeus as the head of the Joint Special Operations Command, JSOC, during the surge from 2007 to 2008. Again, as in Afghanistan, where they're repeating what they did in Iraq, they had two tactics. One, to bribe what they consider the insurgency with money so that they come over to the occupation forces, and two, to terrorize the population with assassinations. The Iraqi government estimated that in the first months of 2008 alone, over 3,000 members of the anti-occupation Shiite Mahdi army militia were killed, mainly by covert operations, the modus operandi of McChrystal. In Afghanistan, these aren't covert operations. What we have described in these free fire kill zones and in these escalation of force operations is pure assassination of the population.
Well, most specifically, Maya, McChrystal was chosen by Obama to head U.S. NATO forces in Afghanistan because of the success of his murder operations, death squad operations across Iraq. In fact, under McChrystal's command, Afghanistan and northwest Pakistan are free fire kill zones in which jet fighters, gunships, and predator drones stalk the skies while gangs of heavily armed and highly trained death squad special forces scour the ground, killing anyone perceived to be hostile or in resistance or merely to be sympathetic to the resistance. In case after case, the people they slaughter are defenseless men, women, and children.
And many of these are what are called CAS, close air support actions. That is where men on the ground who are under fire call in for airplanes. And I want to look at one of these closely. And this is an Afghan massacre. The strikes came in 20 minutes apart. Three village landmarks were targeted, a mosque and two compounds. The airplanes, the two F-18 fighter jets and a B-1 bomber, were based outside Afghanistan, were called in, and they slaughtered the people in the village. 147 Afghans known to have died when the American bombs were dropped on houses that were packed with terrified women and children and the elderly who had been seeking shelter from a nearby battle between the so-called insurgents and the U.S.-backed Afghan government forces. The U.S.-backed Afghan government forces called in their American mentors, who then called in the fighter bombers. And the fighter bombers leveling the village, three bombing strikes 20 minutes apart on what they considered the standing landmarks, that is the mosque and two compounds filled with women and children. Ralph.
Well, Maya, it's interesting to note here that the New York Times acknowledges in just last year 586 such civilian deaths in Afghanistan, which were blamed on the actions of the occupation forces. But the Times states, and the United Nations confirms, that special force units were responsible for these. And more significantly, as we've discussed in prior broadcasts, there is a sinister off-the-books private mercenary operation which identifies targets for assassination and which is essentially a mercenary operation, private mercenary troops that are carrying out the same kind of butchery off the record, off the books.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenemann
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Annihilation of Afghanistan, Part 2. Ralph, I want to continue with discussion of this assassination, 147 people. This was in Ghorani, which is 22 miles from the provincial capital in Afghanistan's western Farah province. It's the Bala Baluch district.
Well, Maya, let me just mention that what you're reciting and describing here occurred a full year ago. And as it was reported in the Los Angeles Times on May 17th, 2009, and the point about this is that no matter when you pick up the newspaper, there is such an account. It's not yesterday or last week. It's 1 year ago. It's 2 years ago. It's every month of the year. This is an ongoing, continuing process.
Ralph, this article in the Los Angeles Times by Laura King is one of the most in-depth articles that I've seen about the massacre in Afghanistan. Laura King devoted a lot of attention to speaking to people in the village, to the military, to the doctors. Let's look at the details of the massacre in Ghorani. Laura King interviewed the mourning villagers, the provincial authorities, doctors, human rights activists about the fighting on May 4th that showed a massacre by the U.S. forces. She found four blistered and bandaged little girls laying side by side in hospital beds. One of them, a five-year-old Farishta, writhed and cried almost continuously, unable to find a position that did not cause her pain from the burns that covered her arms, legs, and torso. On the night of May 4th, the girls' families, frightened by hours of fierce fighting between the insurgents, the so-called insurgents, and the Afghan and Western troops in and around Ghorani, had sought shelter together with dozens of neighbors in a pair of sprawling compounds belonging to the village's most powerful tribal clans. After the clashes subsided in the early evening, residents said, many were bedding down by about 8:30, still huddled together in hope of safety. That, they say, is when the bombs fell. 9-year-old Nazibi, whose large brown eyes were half hidden by swollen eyelids with eyelashes burned away, remembered falling asleep with her mother and 10-year-old sister by her side. I heard a big boom and I was buried except for my head, she said. Everything collapsed, the roof was on me, and there were flames. I was so frightened. Her sister Gulbadin was killed. Her mother Sanam suffered burns but survived, although the night's events so unhinged her that she apparently suffered a mental collapse. Because of the seriousness of their conditions, the girls were eventually brought to the country's best burn treatment center at the regional hospital in Herat, about 150 miles north of Farah City. Ralph?
Whatever emerges, the events that took place, Laura King writes, in this desolate patch of western desert stand as a microcosm of the Afghan war, she writes. Nurses and doctors stated that Nazbibi's father, Saeed Malam, rarely left her bedside. Like many of the village's men, he works as a laborer across the border and did not learn of the catastrophe that had befallen his family until 2 days later. Marie José Brunel, the nurse working for a French humanitarian group that helps run the unit, grimaced when asked if the child would live. She wasn't sure. What we have to understand here is that the burns we are describing are caused by chemicals. by chemicals, by high-flaring magnesium bombs, by white phosphorus.
And Ralph, the fact that this was phosphorus was investigated by the Associated Press, the New York Times, and other media outlets. An article by the Associated Press, Probe into Burns Suffered in Afghan Battle, appeared in May of 2009 by Jason Trizuzzo and Rahim Faiz. And they spoke to the doctors at the Herat Hospital, who said that the villagers wounded in the fighting had, quote, unusual burns. How unusual? These were the burns that are typical of white phosphorus. The head of the burn unit, Dr. Mohammed Arif Jalili, at the Herat Regional Hospital, said that he had treated the five patients wounded in the battle. He said, quote, I think it's the result of a chemical used in a bomb, but I'm not sure what kind of chemical. But if it was the result of a burning house from petrol or gas cylinders, that kind of burn would look different. Colonel Greg Julian, the top U.S. military spokesman in Afghanistan, said that the U.S. did not use white phosphorus as a weapon in last week's battle. He said the U.S. does use white phosphorus, however, to illuminate the night sky. But when you look at the actual circumstances of this, you find out that he is lying. Ralph.
Well, Maya, the use of white phosphorus has been ubiquitous by the United States as it is by the Israelis. I want to say parenthetically that you and I were in Lebanon at the time of the Israeli invasion in 1982, living in the Palestinian camps. And when we were in Beirut, subject to complete blockade and saturation bombing, white phosphorus was used everywhere. And we witnessed the victims of white phosphorus, and it is a fiendish weapon, brothers and sisters. White phosphorus cannot be extinguished by water. When you are hit by white phosphorus, it eats through the flesh and bone. If it's used in an artillery round, it literally disintegrates the body, and the victims are consumed by festering and blistering flesh and the innards of their body, and they die inevitably and in enormous pain. The U.S. denied using white phosphorus. They use it throughout Fallujah. There's no ambiguity about that. The Pentagon has acknowledged that it used white phosphorus directly as a weapon in the assault on Fallujah, in a 300,000 populated city in which civilians throughout that city were doused in white phosphorus. It's the ubiquitous weapon of terror that the U.S. uses in Afghanistan as in Iraq.
Ralph, in Iraq, first the U.S. denied that it had used white phosphorus in Fallujah. Then when it was proven that they had used white phosphorus, they said that they first used it as an illumination, which is legal, and then they said they used it as a smoke screen to hide the troops. Going to Afghanistan, an article by C.J. Chivers in the May 14th, 2009 edition of the New York Times, his article, Karangal Memo in Bleak Afghan Outpost, Troops Slog On. Within that article, we find out about white phosphorus. Chivers wrote, the soldiers detected a Taliban spotter on a ridge, and the soldiers then pounded it with mortars and white phosphorus rounds from a 155-millimeter howitzer. The Americans then escalated, and an A-10 aircraft made several gun runs and dropped a 500-pound bomb. It is clear from the passage just cited that the military was using phosphorus shells. As you can see, they were using these phosphorus shells in the 155-millimeter howitzer. They were trying to destroy the outpost with shells and bombs. The last thing that they wanted to do was to provide the enemy spotter with a smoke cover, because that would help him escape. Or he could have hidden from the A-10 ground attack planes. In broad daylight, the U.S. military was firing white phosphorus from their howitzer. Ralph.
They've used depleted uranium. They've used radioactive weapons. They're effectively using tactical nuclear weapons. They use every chemical in the arsenal that they provided to various of their puppets and that they deployed throughout every military combat that they've exercised, whether it's in Yugoslavia, the Balkans, or in the Middle East, or in Central Asia. Indeed, on April 6th, the report, again, from the New York Times, and it's described as well with appropriate commentary by Tom Ely in the World Socialist website, U.S. Special Forces cover up massacres of Afghans. A NATO military statement issued Sunday acknowledged that U.S. Special Force commandos have carried out the execution-style killings of women and men in February 12th raid in southeastern Afghanistan. Among the dead women were two pregnant mothers with 16 children, between them the third a teenage girl. For weeks, the U.S.-led NATO officials had denied the killing of the women. After the killings, U.S. Special Forces dug their bullets out of the dead women's bodies and treated the holes with alcohol to erase forensic evidence, an Afghanistani government investigation determined. The United Nations official confirmed that the Afghan investigation found that U.S. soldiers routinely tamper with these crime scenes. These reports are substantiated by family members, by local authorities who state that U.S. soldiers blocked access for 7 hours to the home in Gardez, the regional capital of Eastern Paktia province, while they attempted to cover up the crime. Now, this is the first time that its forces killed the women and did not attempt a cover-up. All regrettable is the comment by Rear Admiral Greg Smith, the top military spokesman in Kabul. There is absolutely no evidence, he then added, that the forces covered anything up, unquote, a bald-faced lie. The evidence of all the investigations acknowledges the cover-up, and a rather crude one at that.
Ralph, I think we should look at this incredible article from Frontline, which is an Indian magazine, that we picked up when we were in India and Pakistan in 2008. It's from October 24th, 2008, issue of Frontline. It's called Matrix of Death, a new dossier on the imprecision of U.S. bombing and the undervaluation of Afghan lies by Mark Herold. Herold does an incredible statistical evaluation of the bombing raids, particularly these close air support raids. That is when the bombers are called in to support the ground forces. He reveals that the CAS airstrikes account for 80% of all Afghan civilians who perish at the hands of the U.S. and NATO, and that there is much underdocumenting of these assassinations. He gives some amazing examples. The Times reporting from Kandahar on May 24, 2007, about the near obliteration of Gurno on May 8, 2007. Mr. Lilai's village, a settlement in Sarwan Kala Valley north of Sangin, which is patrolled by British troops, was bombed by aircraft on the night of May 8th after fighting between the Taliban and foreign soldiers. Crawling wounded from the wreckage of his home, Mr. Lilai discovered that his grandfather, grandmother, wife, father, 3 brothers, and 4 sisters had died in the bombing. The youngest victim was 8, the oldest 80. Only Mr. Lalai's mother and 2 sons aged 5 and 3 survived. Both boys were wounded. Yet the forces that wiped out his family were not British, nor those of any other NATO unit. The airstrikes were called in by the American Special Forces, operating with their own rules of engagement on a mission totally devolved from NATO command in Afghanistan. At least 21 Afghan civilians died. Ralph?
The document is, as you say, quite extraordinary, revealing that Human Rights Watch counts only 50% of the Afghan civilians killed, and the figure compiled by the Associated Press is a mere 33%. With a ton of precision bombs, U.S. NATO forces, he writes, kill 10 times more Afghan civilians than they killed Serbs in 1999. But an Afghan life is treated as worth one-tenth of an Alaskan sea otter.
Ralph, the lethality of U.S. bombing in Afghanistan exceeded by far that recorded in Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Yugoslavia, Iraq of 2003, and even Afghanistan of 2001 with the incredible bombing of Afghanistan as the Bush administration supposedly was looking for Osama bin Laden.
Just in the year 2008, the order of magnitude of the recorded bombings in Afghanistan are admitted to have been the deadly equivalent of U.S. carpet bombing of Cambodia and the Allied bombing of Germany during the Second World War. Disaggregated data for 2006 reveals that hundreds upon hundreds of Afghan civilians died as the result of these U.S. NATO attacks. The number of attacks was 80, meaning that 8 to 10 persons perished per attack. The matrix of death for 2008 indicates that of the total number of Afghan civilians killed, air attacks killed the great majority of them, and aerial attacks were 3 to 4 times as deadly for Afghan civilians as were ground attacks.
Ralph, the level of bombing is incredible. He notes that the U.S. and Britain dropped 1,996,036 tons of bombs upon Germany during the Second World War, killing an estimated 600,000 Germans, or 30 civilians per 100 tons of bombs dropped. During the first 4 months of 1945 alone, the Allied bombing of Germany was unprecedented. 180,000 tons of bombs were dropped, killing 119,000 persons. This is just in 4 months, which was a ratio of 66 people killed per 100 tons of bombs dropped. He then creates a chart comparing World War II, North Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, the Iraq Gulf War, Yugoslavia, Afghanistan in 2001, 2006, 2007, and 2008 to get his statistic that the lethality of the U.S. bombing in Afghanistan exceeds that recorded in Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Yugoslavia, Iraq, and Afghanistan of 2001. It is incredible.
In the village of Hazar Kadam, Uruzgan province, Aminullah 25 was sleeping when rockets hit the Islamic school, the Shazam High School. U.S. troops burst into the school, spraying it with bullets. He saw his cousin struggle, but Aminullah, fearing for his life, fled to hide in the village mosque. When he returned, he found his cousin dead with bullets in his neck, stomach, and shoulder. Barigul described how Haji Sana, his brother, died. He was heading up a group of 18 Afghans. The U.S. occupation forces beat them, abducted all of them and 9 of the civilians, keeping them in wooden barred cages and beating them for 2 weeks solid at the Kandahar base. Ala Nur 40, a farmer, suffered broken ribs from the beatings. The masked U.S. Special Forces troops killed 14 in one compound, 2 in a second compound. Villagers later found local men dead with their hands tied behind their backs with plastic bands stenciled with the words, "Made in USA, killed, execution style." And he continues, less than 10 days after the attack, the Central Intelligence Agency visited the village. Barigul, whose brother was a member of a local disarmament commission and was slaughtered by the U.S. Special Forces, was given 10 $100 bills. 5.5 years later, the U.S. military stated it intended to pay compensation to families of 16 village victims killed in an airstrike in Tulakan, west of Kandahar. The U.S. military said 16 civilians had been killed, but rights groups like the Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission stated the actual number was 37. This is throughout Afghanistan. The family of Gardez Khan was given a compensation amount of $1,600 for the murder of their family.
Ralph, yes, we should note that the U.S. comes in and pays what is called compensation to the people they slaughter. In villages, they will hand out $2,000, that's 100,000 Afghanis, for a dead relative, and 50,000 Afghanis, $1,000, for those injured. Kill them and then pay them
a token
off.
Amount to the family. What is a child worth? What is a wife worth? What is a sister or a brother or a father worth? It's counted in a few dollars. The bombings, the targeted killings, the ubiquitous terrorizing of the population in Afghanistan is an echo of the way the Nazis occupied Europe. It is a repeat of what was done throughout Indochina. It is an escalation what has transpired in Afghanistan. It is a little continuation of the Imperium engaged in genocide wherever it operates and whomever it occupies, brothers and sisters. They are going on in slaughter now overseas, and we are targeted in the very near future. Our struggle is against a vicious system in terminal decay, and we cannot relent in our opposition, resistance, and pledge to overthrow this system of cruelty, exploitation, and terror. Maya, who is the architect of the current operation in Afghanistan as he was in Iraq? It is Robert M. Gates, who was the person selected by Barack Obama to be the point man for his policies and indeed the Secretary of Defense. Robert Gates was the Secretary of Defense of Presidents George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush. He joined the staff of the National Security Council, serving under Presidents Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, and Jimmy Carter until 1979, when he returned to the CIA. He was tainted with Watergate. He was involved in the operation known as the October Surprise, when he was with H.W. Bush and James Baker in Paris, arranging secretly for the then hostages held by the Khomeini regime to be maintained until the election was over and not to be released prior to the election, to guarantee that Carter would lose that election. He rose to the post of deputy director of the CIA in 1982. Reagan nominated him to be director in 1987. But then he had to withdraw because of his involvement in the Iran-Contra affair, in which he was engaged in an illegal enterprise overriding Congress's decision to oppose the introduction of counterinsurgency forces in Nicaragua. And this was done with Oliver North, as you will remember, brothers and sisters, in a fraudulent operation in which they were selling arms to the Iranian regime in exchange for money which was used to support the Contras and indeed invested in drugs to provide for the counterinsurgency terror operations throughout Nicaragua. Then when he was called to testify before Congress about his involvement in these events, he lied about it and was caught out in his lies under oath before Congress. And what was the consequence of this? Why, he was simply nominated to continue, not merely in the National Security Council, but as head of the CIA. Appropriately, the defense secretary for George W. Bush, and revealingly, the point man for Barack Obama in his slaughter ongoing in Iraq and now Afghanistan. It is one big property party with two names, brothers and sisters, and Barack Obama, no less than Bush, Reagan, Carter, or Nixon, is an instrument and agent of imperial dominion and genocide on a planetary scale.
We will continue with this subject next week, particularly the DEPCA analysis, the Afghanistan War is Unwinnable. This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Annihilation of Afghanistan Part 2, will be on our website, www.takingaimradio.com.
Wow, big no bin yai. Tatam ta chinam paro, tatam